Welcome to Against the Wind. I'm Dr. Paul, your host. Today's show features an interview I did with Michelle Perro, MD. She has 40 years of experience in emergency medicine, hospital, urgent care work, and integrative medicine practice, both in the city, suburban. She has worked in the U.S. and internationally. Listed for many years as America's top 10 pediatricians by Consumer Reports, she's the executive director of GMOScience.org. And co-authored the book, What's Making Our Children Sick? I have to tell you, we covered everything COVID-related, how her career has changed over the years, environmental medicine, information out of her book, and also her take on COVID and what's going on, the monkeypox and GMO issues, and where do we go from here? We will then round out the show with Bernadette presenting the information about COVID vaccines in infant and young children, because that's been the latest push recently by the FDA and the CDC. The fact that it's an all-risk proposition with no benefit for kids. There's no long-term clinical trials, not now or ever. They're just not doing them. And the negative efficacy and how we've got some real problems with our immune system's response to these vaccines and the fact that treatment exists. Enjoy the show. So Dr. Paul here, coming to you from the heart. I am at the Oregon coast, so the audio might not be as ideal as usual, but I'm self-isolating because I have COVID, and I'm day four. I actually feel almost 100%. Mine was just a minor scratchy throat, slight headache, one morning of a few hours of high fever. I didn't take my temperature. I was on vacation, but felt really warm. Intense body aches for a few hours, and then that's been about it. I have slight congestion, occasional mucus in my throat here like a cold, and I'm done. Just not a big deal. I'm not trying to minimize COVID, especially what was in the past for those who went through the Wuhan variant, and then the Delta wasn't as severe, but for some it was. But this Omicron, I'm presuming that's what I've just gone through. I tested positive. I was at a family reunion, so here's an interesting story I think is worth sharing. We had 35 people gathering in three houses and then having evening meetings of togetherness and community sharing and all of that. We shared evening meals. Two individuals arrived to this group of 35. Clearly, retrospectively, they had COVID. They didn't know it at the time. They developed fever, body aches, headaches, a little bit of sore throat, and tested positive. We isolated to the best we can, but you know, this latest variant is so contagious that it's pretty impossible to avoid it. What's interesting is there were a handful of us who were not vaccinated, and most people were vaccinated, mostly completely. Some got the initial series, not the boosters. We have had the first person to get it was an 80-year-old grandma who was completely vaccinated with two boosters, and a 7-year-old granddaughter, who I don't think was vaccinated. They both recovered within 2-3 days. And then we then had my 90-year-old parents both get it. My 60-year-old sister, myself, I'm 65, and a couple other individuals, one who came with it from a different part of the world. And bottom line is everyone, including the 90-year-olds, including the 80-year-olds, everybody's recovering fairly quickly. This is great news that this current variant that's out there is really not dangerous, even to high-risk individuals. At least that's how it seems. That's certainly been our experience. I'm not trying to say that you shouldn't listen to advice from trusted professionals, but that's the cool news. Folks, it is, from my experience now, a lot like a common cold, nothing to be fearful of. I will point out that those of us who were unvaccinated had been very careful to be supplementing with adequate levels of vitamin D, taking some selenium, some N-acetylcysteine, some zinc, and then there was access to ivermectin. Yeah, I know you've been hearing on the news. You're not supposed to use that, but it's being used worldwide very successfully. American frontline doctors, lots of physicians who are treating COVID are having amazing success using ivermectin. That was made available to everybody that became ill in this family reunion and may have played a part in the fact that nobody got sick. Not dangerously ill, not even significantly ill. We had quick recoveries within a day or two by everybody because they were started on these supplements as soon as they arrived at the reunion, and then they were started on ivermectin if they turned positive with symptoms. So I thought that would be an important update coming to you from the heart. Love you all. Take care. Stay well. Stay healthy. And enjoy the outdoors. Get out any chance you have. There's nothing better than sunshine, fresh air, and being with nature.
Welcome, Dr. Michelle Perreault. I have been waiting to meet you. I don't know how our paths didn't cross. You've been doing pediatrics for 40 years, including emergency medicine, hospital and urgent care work. Then you went into integrative practice, both city and suburban. You've worked in the U.S. and internationally, listed at America's top 10 pediatricians for multiple years by Consumer Reports. Good for you. And you're the executive director of GMOscience.org, the founder of DrMichellePerreault.com, co-author of a book, What's Making Our Children Sick? When I read that your quote, I'm focused on solution-based non-pharma interventions for families, teaching people how to regain their health from the ground up, I thought, we need you on this show. So welcome to Against the Wind.
Well, thank you for the introduction. And that intro reminds me how long I've been at this.
You have, and you've done so much. I can't wait to have our audience hear what you have to share. Let's start, though, with, we're at a similar age in terms of our background and training, and then we ended up in integrative work in some form or another. Share with folks, you know, how your career started as far as your training and then how it sort of evolved.
Certainly. I'll make it brief. 40 years, a lot to unpack, but my interest and passion was always in acute care. And I was a pediatric emergency physician, helped start the first PALS course as a life support course in New York City. I somehow, after residency, got myself to run an ER at a Metropolitan Hospital in New York. I don't know how I did that, but, you know, sort of did that. And then was in peds emergency medicine for a long time. And then what happened was my own kid had health challenges. And I serendipitously met an MD homeopath, Dr. Kenze, who I still adore. And this woman told me to give my son a homeopathic remedy for a croup. And, you know, and as a pediatrician, your kid doesn't have regular croup. They have the like worst kind of croup, like, you know, where they're choking in the middle of the night. And the remedy cleared my son like that in five minutes. Repeated it again. I said, come on, really? I was actually shocked and horrified that there could be this type of medicine that I didn't know about. Little sugar pills you buy in, the store. So transitioned to homeopathy. And through working in Dr. Kenze's office, I met a mom focused on stopping the spray of a pesticide, insecticide, that was to occur along the entire coast of Northern California, which I did not want to get into because I was a soccer mom, PTA chair, running a practice, the whole thing. And I did, because I said, Michelle, put up or shut up. And I just felt the need to do it. They stopped the spray. And then I learned about GMOs and pesticides. But concomitantly, I was seeing, and I was running my own practice, integrative urgent care, but I was seeing an uptick in gastrointestinal disorders and autistic behaviors, the whole spectrum. Mm-hmm. And when I read Seeds of Deception, Jeffrey Smith's book at that time, and this was about 2005, my whole world flipped upside down because I wasn't focused on food as medicine, GMOs and pesticides, environmental toxicants, but I understood this relationship between gut, later gut-brain, later gut-brain microbiome health, and later psychoneuroendoimmunology with the link to the microbiome. So it was this evolutionary process, and I've never turned back since, because you can't unknow what you've known. And so onward I go.
Wow. There you have it, folks. Lots of big words for the scientists who got that. That was awesome. But I had the same journey. I woke up around 2003. I had a child who was not developing as he should have. I was pretty sure something was going on with environmental toxins, and got that down that exact same path of realizing, you know, the toxins in our world, including those in vaccines, but, you know, the GMOs, the pesticides, and we've since learned about plastics and all the other things that are, you know, endocrine disruptors, et cetera. It career-wise, isn't this exciting?
So exciting. It's a game changer. And, you know, you look around and you wonder why everyone's not doing it because it's so effective. Yes, the downside is we as practitioners have to relearn a lot. And we've literally had to go to naturopathic school and become naturopaths and learn homeopathy and manipulatives and all those tools that we now have in our toolboxes. But isn't that the joy and the beauty of what we do, that we grow with our patients and that we, as we expand, they expand. And so the idea is not to shut down as we age, but to expand not only our level of knowledge, which is limited, but our consciousness. Because before I become high compost, I want to get up here somewhere, Paul, you know, ascend and expand heartfelt love, consciousness, energetic healing. That's where I'm headed. And I know that's the key, but I'm like stumbling along, you know, like most of us, trying to figure out how to get there. There's no manual for each of us, but I do know these tools in our toolbox work.
I can't let that pass without asking you to expand a little bit. So I've reached that same conclusion just this year. Prior to this year, I was busy learning naturopathic approaches, environmental health, gut biome, all the things you were talking about. And it's become clear to me that it's this energy. It's also the spiritual journey. Touch on that a little more. How do we, you know, the viewers and other physicians and providers, how do we move forward in that important path journey that we need to move on?
So what I recognize and support and try to educate others is the need to reestablish our consciousness and our energetic path. And the way I do that is practically, because I'm a practical gal, you know, boots on the ground, let's get rid of the fluff, and is homeopathy. Now we know, and you know, and I know that, you know, Rockefeller and the Flexner Report and his brother-in-law, Abraham Flexner, try to get rid of homeopathy. People have to recognize that at the turn of the 20th century, there were over 900 homeopaths practicing in San Francisco. So homeopathy was a huge part of our practice, not to mention that Boston College, Hahnemann, Jefferson, UCSF were all homeopathic schools, medical schools. This was massive. And they single-handedly got rid of it by shaming and creating the pharma industry. So reteaching people about energy medicine, homeopathy is just energy. Right? That's all it is. And it's you're matching people's frequency. So I have gotten back into teaching people about homeopathy. I kept it quiet for decades because of the amount of eye rolling I received from colleagues and others. I mean, I could go around the planet with as many eye rolls as I've received over the decades. And I just became quiet about it, but not because of shame or fear, just because I didn't want to get it eliminated. I wanted to keep it going. It's always under attack and under some threat, and we keep fighting for its rights. Mm-hmm. So understanding energy, teaching people how to use these energy medicines, but also how to shift their own bioenergetic state through removing negative emotions, balancing on harmony, meditation, love, compassion, and not that it sounds like fake it till you make it, but sort of see if we could shift from negative emotion and isolation and fear, which is what we're doing now. But mm-hmm. I think we're on the other side of it, Paul. I'm hopeful, optimism, and teaching people how do we embrace this positive energy and use energetic tools to regain our health. And that's what I'm doing. And simple. And there are simple tools we can teach folks how to do this at home.
Well, let's pivot to your first book, What's Making Our Children Sick?
Yeah, talk about dark and negative. That was Dr. Doom and Gloom. How to expose it. That was based on my patients. You know, we wrote about 10. My co-author, Dr. Adams, is a UCSF medical anthropologist. And when we first collaborated, and Dr. Adams shares this herself, she didn't believe a word of what I was saying. Complete denial. I was crazy. You know, Harvard, Mayo Clinic, they said the exact opposite. I was right. I was like, no, listen to the patients. Let's go to the clinic. And after about her 10th visit sitting in with me, she was like, oh my God. So she interviewed 20. We wrote about 10, and these are all their stories. And it's really based on industrial food-like products, the effects of GMOs. GMOs are not benign. Genetically engineered products, whether we're eating them, breathing them, or injecting them, are not benign because they alter DNA. Let's be clear. So the food alters the DNA in your microbiome, and they have other effects as well. The injectables alter the DNA in your liver, you know, systemically, and we know that. And there's good science based on that as well. So I could talk about genetic engineering. Let's hold that to the book. And it's an academic book. We have like 260 references, but it was written 5 years ago. I reread it recently. Is it still valid? It's still valid. And there's only one thing I would change, Paul, because in that book, we wrote about warrior moms, because in the practice, I only saw women. Mm-hmm. And I was dead set on just getting moms to change this paradigm and the shift. Mm-hmm. And that was a misstep. And now, since then, when I do parent interviews and talking to the parents, I insist that the other parent is there, whoever that may be, dad or other, that both parents, often dad, because to not include men in the conversation was a mistake. Because women can naturally, and I say that I can see all the eye rolls now regarding this kind of gender language, but mm-hmm. some of us gals gravitate more toward health and education, and that is not inclusive. So that's the only thing I would change. And this is a shout out to all the dads to become included in the dialogue and understanding what's making our children sick and how to make our children well, because they are sick.
Yeah. Well, that's so interesting. I've always given a shout out to the warrior moms, because so often in our practice, we do, you know, hands-on pediatric work. It's the moms who are bringing the kids into the visits. And oftentimes they're the ones who get really passionate. Oftentimes they're the ones at home caring for, you know, kids who aren't doing well, right? Kids who have chronic, severe neurodevelopmental issues that are environmentally triggered. Certainly they're not genetic. I mean, these were kids who were doing great and now they're not. But you're absolutely right. The dads are key. And when you can get a mom and a dad or a couple, you know, we're not being specific about gender here, but you just have parents, guardians who are working together. It's so powerful.
Couldn't agree more. And, you know, and just a note to that, you know, because I mean, I got crazed over autistic spectrum disorder. That's where I absolutely lost my mind. And ticking up. Since we wrote the book, I just can't believe it. You know, it's even up higher. 1 in 33 kids now. I mean, it's like just shocking. And I used to say as a joke, if you want to teach kids about birth control, have them spend the night with a kid with diarrhea all night. But now I don't say that. I said, have them spend the night with a kid on the spectrum, because those kids don't sleep well. And what we have is chronically sleep deprived families. And when you have neurodevelopmentally challenged children, there are frequently not 90% of gut issues, and a significant number have sleep issues. You know, they're like two-thirds of children now under the age of 10 have dysomnias or abnormal sleep patterns. And so the whole family is sleep deprived, and everyone's dysfunctional. And you and I know, and we'll share with the listeners, your immune system repairs at night, and you clean out brain toxicants and toxins at night. All that happens while you're sleeping. So if sleep's impaired, nothing good is going on. Yep. And then parents start fighting, and then the whole house of cards falls. So that's sort of my little, you know, lesson.
So let me ask you a question. When you were in medical school and you were doing your pediatric training for those 4 years of medicine and then the 3 years of pediatric subspecialty, how many cases of severe autism did you see?
I had one case, and that was at Metropolitan Hospital where I was working. It was about 1 in 10,000, I think the incidence was, and this was 1985. And I remember thinking, what the heck is this? And it was a boy actually who developed autism after falling out a window that mm-hmm. was unguarded in the city of New York. Mm-hmm. And since then they put those guards on the windows because of his case actually. And so now like grandma can diagnose a kid on the spectrum because it's so common. You walk down the street, American classrooms look like special needs.
Yep.
And you ask any teacher, any first grade teacher, if you want to know about what's happening in the classroom.
I had the exact same experience. Zero cases in medical school. In fact, they took us, I was at Dartmouth, and they took us to Hartford, Connecticut, to a Down syndrome community for us to learn about developmental delays and developmental issues. There was zero autism. And then I had a couple of cases of mild PDD NOS in residency, which is what we might term spectrum today. This is something new and different, folks. And you're an expert in environmental medicine. Take a stab at what do you think's going on? Why are we seeing this massive epidemic of neurodevelopmental challenges?
So and there is no doubt in my mind, Paul, that this is a multifactorial issue. There's no doubt. And could genetics play a role? Yeah, but that's not the main driver. Sure. And so I think that there are several reasons why. It has to do with the effects of environmental toxicants. So toxins are organic, toxicants are inorganic, and both impact future generations of children. They affect the microbiome, that collection of organisms creating a massive imbalance called dysbiosis. They affect children's epigenetics, which are the little molecules that sit on top of genes that get turned on and off in response to various toxicants in the environment. And so that will tell what your body, the DNA, what proteins to produce via two processes, methylation and acylation. And it doesn't matter, but many children who have neurodevelopmental challenges have these issues called methylation issues where they cannot detoxify well. And it's almost like 85% of them have some type of these methylation issues. Okay. It's also the heavy metals. Metals are in baby food. They are in vaccines. They are in the air, chemtrails, you can believe it or not. They are in water. They're ubiquitous. They're certainly in pesticides. As a matter of fact, Roundup, a great paper that came out in 2015 by Dr. Gilles-Éric Cerullini showed that Roundup itself was contaminated with heavy metals. And I love to quote, and I know I'm getting a bit long-winded here, one of my favorite papers was by Gatti et al. From Italy in 2017, which looked at 44 standard vaccines. One of them was Felagen. It's a cat vaccine, but 43 were children's vaccines. And all but the cat vaccine contain nanocontamination of heavy metals. And some organic, like calcium, magnesium, many inorganic, like chromium, tin, tungsten, aluminum, mercury, et cetera. And they were nanoparticles. The problem with nanoparticles is they're very tiny, 10 to the minus 9. So they cross the blood-brain barrier. They activate children's neuroimmune cells called microglial cells and causing brain inflammation. When the brain's inflamed, it doesn't behave properly. And how does that manifest in children? Learning challenges, speech challenges, outburst of abnormal behavior, sleep disruption, as we mentioned. And so to calm down that neuroinflammation is very challenging. This is not an easy thing to do, but it can be done, and it's not easy. So we have injected, fed our children, have them breathe, drink, inhale a slew of environmental toxicants, and then we want to know why they're not well. Where is there a modicum of common sense?
Amen. So pivoting from that, I wonder if you've had a similar experience that I've had, which is, you know, as we become aware of the whole picture with environmental toxins, including those in vaccines, we also become more able to hear parents who are talking to us in our practice, who are saying, you know, I got these vaccines and my kid regressed, or I'm concerned about these vaccines. And we talk about all the other toxins as well, not just the vaccines. Have you had in your practice over the years a growing number of unvaccinated families and seen a difference in how their children are doing compared to our typical highly vaccinated kids?
Absolutely. And, you know, certainly, and I read Hooker's study, looking at 1900 kids who, over time, I think almost 2000, you know, those who vaccinated, partially vaccinated, unvaccinated. And of course, the healthiest children were unvaccinated, breastfed. Clinically myself, our healthiest children are certainly what I've seen anecdotally, it's not published, where the kids who are healthiest were unvaccinated, breastfed. And it's definitely that combination. Formula is not an ideal situation. Of course, I understand the need. I get it. You know, we don't have to go down there. But boy, I'm really careful with formula and formula advice. to families, especially parents who adopt or moms can't breastfeed, or there might be two dads or whatever's going on. So I know that to be true. And, you know, I didn't start out this path, and I hate the terminology that's anyone who questions a rhetoric is an anti this or an anti that. And right. How successful a PR campaign is that nonsense? It's absolute nonsense. But if you don't question any modality that we're doing to a child, I think that's nothing short of child abuse. I mean, we would give Tylenol nilly-willy, and look at that. Acetaminophen reduces glutathione, is linked to autism. Yes. So we have to constantly reevaluate what we've done. Now, we went with the best intentions, thinking we're vaccinating and protecting our children against measles. But little did we know that the original MMR with thimerosal, now aluminum, now nano-aluminum, crosses their blood-brain barrier. And so we have to ask the wisdom of what are we doing? And so it's not, I'm looking for Vax 2.0. Vax homeopathically, you know, just don't put in toxic metals and injectables where kids can't clear it, because you bypass their gut, their liver, and their innate immunity all in one. And what that does is you're just creating a very limited immune response to a potential immunotoxic agent. And where's the wisdom?
Yeah. Well said. We got a whole bunch of quotes right in there. What's your take on COVID then? The illness and the vaccine, you can even call it a vaccine.
And I don't. I call it an immunomodulator. And I call it gene therapy immunomodulator. And I've given that talk because it's not a vaccine per se. Well, the CDC changed the definition, so maybe it's now looked at that way. But it's an immunomodulating gene therapy, which is shown to alter DNA. And that's been clearly defined in the literature. So let's call it what it is. I've had problems with COVID since I don't know if I got it right away when it first started, but I certainly started reading the papers because I'm a big fan of Dr. Luc Montagnier. The HIV discoverer, Nobel Prize winner, well-spoken French person, physicist, scientist, physician who died recently. And I listen to him whenever I can because he was so clear. And when I heard Dr. Luc speak about how this was an impossible virus, and he showed the genetic sequences of little pieces of HIV, Ebola, you know, Corona, I don't know, it's like a little mosaic, how attractive. I knew this was some serious BS, and that, yes, this was a bioweapon, a gene drive, I don't know what. And so for those of us who've treated Lyme disease before, like myself, we understand this bioweaponry concept because Lyme is a bioweapon. And I have references for that as well, because people are probably going, what? Lyme is a bioweapon. I wonder about HIV. I wonder about RSV. I wonder about a lot of these pathogens. But anyway, that aside, you know, I'm not a geneticist. I'm not a virologist. But we as pediatricians are certainly act like virologists, because for 40 years, we've been seeing viral infections, right? That's what we are. So I suspect that. And that's why I don't like this illness, because I suspect that I don't think that it's a great idea for people to get infected with these gene modified products. Many seem to be handling it well. Some clearly not. The long haulers, long COVID, call it what you will, whether they have underlying chronic infection or not from other pathogens, I don't know. I don't know their gut function. Most kids have underlying gut dysfunction and then we inject them. So I have concerns about the virus. I have concerns about this nanotechnology, immunomodulating therapy, injectable, because it's toxic from the composition. If you look at the composition, the nanotechnology before COVID in 2015, great paper showing that nanotechnology is inflammatory and cause respiratory issues, neuroinflammation, et cetera. So we knew this nanotechnology is inflammatory. Then you have the nanolipid biologic appearing biosphere that houses the mRNA, because mRNA is very unstable, and that nanolipid is inflammatory. And then you add on the pegylated aspect, polyethylene glycol, which is a kidney toxicant. And many people are allergic to this PEG component. And my goal in life was to get kids off Miralax, which is nothing more than polyethylene glycol. That was my goal in life. If I saw one more kid on 2 years on Miralax, I think I sprouted a few more gray hairs. So PEG, non-toxic. So, and then of course, the spike. you know, I saved the, not the best for last. So we're telling our cells, our this mRNA jab, to produce more spike. And I listen to Stephanie Seneff. I'm colleagues with Stephanie Seneff. I adore her. I wish I could be half as brilliant as she is. And when she explained the difference between spike subunits S1 and S2 from the vaccine versus COVID, I understood things much better. And that spike is systemically toxic to ovaries, prostate, spleen, liver, brain, heart, lung, and also is thrombotic versus two types of thrombosis, be it platelets and just activating the clotting pathway. And last but not least, and this is something that, you know, I struggle with, was this graphene oxide issue. I've seen all kinds of videos and gosh, whatever. And I read about, you know, scientists using graphene oxide in vaccines way before COVID. I mean, there's lots of papers on it. And it certainly, there are links to the patents. If you listen to Karen Kingston regarding patents and graphene oxide. And I've seen some slides that, you know, blew my mind of these like little computer boards in the injected. And I thought, I have to clear the heavy metals because I suspect. So we were not told everything that was in these formulations. And it's so parallel to the GMO situation. We've released a technology and then we as practitioners have to sort out the toxicity, not knowing all the effects of what you put in there because they're trade secrets, they're undisclosed, they're the patent parade. And then we have to sort it out. And so just to clear someone who has COVID long hauler syndrome or vaccine toxicity is difficult because we are playing CSI. Trying to figure out everything that's in there and dealing with the components. That's why the treatment protocols are complex, because you have to treat all those elements, including nanotoxicity. And you have to treat the nanotoxicity. And so it gets, you know, gets in the woo-woo juju thing, you know, oh, treating nanotoxicity is real. And you, and that's why it's so complicated. So I struggle with it because it's really challenging. And I've read all the papers on how it hijacks your, you know, innate immunity and what does interferons and toll-like receptors. I mean, I try to keep up on the literature, and this is all literature from PubMed, you know, and BMJ and Lancet. I mean, any practitioner like us can read this stuff and say, wait a second, you know, it's affecting innate immunity. Kids have a robust innate immunity. So these are the things that I'm grappling with. That was a long-winded answer, Paul. Did I answer the question?
You did an amazing job with that. So let's bring it down to basics for parents. If a parent is watching us chat about this and you've highlighted a whole host of concerns, they're still afraid of getting COVID, the illness, and they're hearing on the news that you know, we need the jab. We need this vaccine to save our kids. What do you have to say to that?
So this is what I say. I say, haven't seen any kids harmed from COVID, the MISC, the multi-system inflammatory thing, haven't seen it. 0.02% of kids may have issues from COVID, way fewer than the flu, the regular influenza virus. So I'd say kids do really well with COVID. And I've seen a lot of kids asymptomatic. No symptoms, sailed on through. The majority sailed on through. If you get systemically ill, fevers, flu-like symptoms, headaches, fatigue, the older kids, for sure. The younger kids, oh my gosh, they're just bouncing off the walls, happy as can be. So that's number one. So kids do well. Kids are not little vectors. They don't go around and vector it to grandma. As a matter of fact, parents transmit to kids versus the other way around, especially in younger children under 10. And I believe here in our great state of California, we are vaccinating the heck out of our kids to protect teachers. I think that they're thinking that we could cocoon them and we vaccinate the kids so adults don't get sick. And I find that nothing short of criminal or unethical, immoral, unconscionable. I'm just horrified about that. So you do not risk children's health to protect adults. I mean, can I say that any more clearly?
Right.
So also what we haven't purported, and there was a study out of Bangladesh looking at 865 people that showed that using povidone iodine, a solution, which you can get over the counter at any like, you know, kind of a camping store. If you spray it in your old carrot in your nose, will clear the virus because they're antiviral. So you can use peroxide solutions, silver solutions, iodine, X-Lear, which is grapefruit seed extract, hypertonic salt, high salt concentration gargles and put in your nose, et cetera, to remove. And if you do that at night as some kind of nightly ritual with your kids, you can eliminate the virus, not to mention RSV, strep, and other pathogens that kids normally get. There were infections before COVID from the oropharynx, from this entire area, and reduce the burden. Have we heard a word about this from our public health officials? Not a word. We've been doing this with strep throat and getting kids to get, you know, eliminate. If, you know, I have a kid with strep in the family. I have the rest of the family members either gargle with hydrogen peroxide and water or use silver spray or whatever to, so they don't get it. And it works. That's an anecdote. I never said
no, that. I do the same, and you're right. It works almost every time. I've had the same experience. I have a large pediatric practice. Not one kid has been hospitalized. Not one kid has had a problem from COVID illness. Lots of kids with severe issues from the vaccine. So parents, you got two pediatricians with, you know, combined 75, 80 years of experience telling you the same thing. Why then, Michelle, Dr. Perot, are our peers not getting it? What the heck's going on?
Oh, darn. Yes. okay. Well, you know, I too, like you, Paul, like many listeners, have listened to DESMET and the mass formation and how it's affecting many people who are highly educated and professional, et cetera. Is it that it? Or have our colleagues, who some of them care as deeply or if not more than I do about children, have they just been so indoctrinated into the vaccine education, which we've been kind of bathed in literally since the first day of medical school, and they cannot move away from that paradigm? Or is it that if we did come to grips with what the potential pathology is from all these vaccinations, injections, jabs, that the shame, the burden that we were involved with that without questioning it, maybe more than a soul could handle? I thought about that too. Reminds me of Munchausen's, right, by proxy. That's the hardest diagnosis for we pediatricians to make, when a loved one would intentionally harm a child, because that is so far out of our reach as humans. One pediatrician colleague of mine, when I asked him if he saw any cardiac issues in his practice, big clinical practitioner. And he said, yeah, they had a kid recently. And I said, well, how did he say, well, he's doing okay. And I said, well, what do you think about that? He goes, well, he said, Michelle, some kids will have to take one for the team. Now that's one individual. And I thought, really, why should any kid have to take one for the team when it's not to their benefit? Because if you look at the statistics, they're not being harmed by this virus. You know, others perhaps with type 2 diabetes, with cardiovascular, sure, but not the kids. So that was, that resonated with me. But I can say there is good news here, because I was contacted today from a colleague in Arizona, and they're forming or have formed a pediatric freedom group. And they're getting petitions around. Pediatricians are waking up. So I think there's a shift. And if I would be so bold to say, I can feel it, because I'm getting emails now from gastroenterologists, ophthalmologists who are treating kids with long COVID, treating their partners. And a gastroenterologist just reached out to me. I'm treating my wife. I think it's hitting that this may not be so kosher. People are waking up.
And that's in medicine. That's how we start to become aware of new problems, right? So we start seeing myocarditis in kids. I'd never seen a case in my entire career. I've already had a kid hospitalized for myocarditis. He went to the pharmacy, got a vaccine. Once it was approved for his age group, well, his parents took him, and you know, he survived, but I don't know that he's going to ever be the same. So I'm really curious if you're willing to share, because I'm a boots on the ground kind of guy too, but we learn from each other what works. What have you found to be most helpful for these difficult situations where it appears to be an immune compromise post-vaccine, post-jab? What sort of things have you found to be helpful?
So, you know, my strategies say, well, are these on one of the kids who are still making spike protein, right? So we know there was a paper that came out recently that showed that from Stanford that spike protein was, it only was studied up for 2 months after the jab, that in the germinal centers, which is the main active part of a lymph node where B cells are made, and there are these B cells, which are main part of your antibody response, that germinal center was biopsied and there was still spike protein 2 months out. So they didn't study after 2 months, but I believe Dr. Cole has reported that some individuals have spike being made even months out afterwards. And I think that was Dr. Cole from Idaho, Ryan Cole. So you have to stop that process of ongoing spike production because the spike is the weapon. And so I like to bind it up. And either I would use ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine to bind it, to bind up spike. So it cannot bind to H2 receptors. It cannot cause endothelial damage. It cannot trigger platelet activation and all that stuff that we know. One. Two, you have to boost their glutathione. Glutathione is the body's master antioxidant, and it also may offset spike. So you can do it as NAC and acetylcysteine. And we practitioners have been using that for 40 years to offset Tylenol overdoses. No stranger to our toolbox. And I love NAC, and you know, the FDA went after it, so it had to be on target. Glutathione is unstable, doesn't taste good. You can inhale glutathione. It's not so easy to get. NAC is much easier to tolerate, to give NAC. You boost kids' antioxidants in terms of vitamin C. Vitamin C, vitamin C, more vitamin C, and as much vitamin C as you can possibly get. Omega-3s are great for a neurologic immune function. I do a lot of omega-3s. I like algae omegas because vegetarians can take them and they don't hurt the environment. I worry about overfishing with using oils from fish. It's like, don't overfish. There's not enough fish for the marine mammals. Let's just use algae. And fish eat the algae. So algae products are good for omega-3s, algae omegas. Okay. Then I use, all my kids are on probiotics or fermented foods to increase their microbiome, their balance, their heterogeneity, the microbiome, because microbiome drives immune function. Vitamin D, more vitamin D, because it's an immune booster. It's a hormone. It's an immune booster. You can do foot baths. You can do Epsom salt baths with a little borax, which will take out the nanotech particles. There's a lot of other things you can do. And then, of course, you want to give them inhibitors of their inflammation, which are called IL-6 inhibitors, things like curcumin, turmeric, curcumin, and you need a lot of curcumin. Eating a little piece of turmeric in your curry is not enough. You need more. And I do activate it with black pepper and fat. How much to do is a whole conversation. You can use green tea extract. So there are things we can use there. And of course, pine needle tea has been shown to be useful. And there's a whole controversy about that. And they'll probably look to get rid of it if I talk about it, why it's so effective. It's probably effective with autism too, but I won't go into that, what it contains. So there are a lot of tools, many tools. And then there are homeopathics. And I'm not sharing with those because that will not be common knowledge or language for our listeners. And they really need to work with a homeopathic practitioner.
Wow. Thank you. You touched on everything I knew and some. So what an awesome outline for our listeners and for everybody who needs to know how to help your loved ones. Maybe it's not you, but maybe you have a loved one that's really suffering post-COVID jab. And of course, some of the things people are suffering with are so bizarre that their doctors don't really know what to make of it. And so it's a coincidence and the connection is not made. So I would say, and Michelle, you can weigh in on this, any new symptom after having had a COVID jab is suspect. What do you think?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because the way I practice medicine now has changed 100%, 180, flipping it around. And the whole lens now is regarding how whether people have received the jab or not, because it's changed their immune function, DNA, neurologic function. Oh, pick it. And so now I have to look at people with their new lenses. And so I'm trying, because it's a bizarre slew of symptoms and things that we have not seen in children are happening to children, like POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia, where kids can't stand up, kids dropping down from, heart attacks. Heart attacks do not happen in children. A stroke drug was released in June by, the FDA for children. Why do children need a stroke drug? And you're right. Myocarditis, 1 in 200,000. I've seen 2 cases in my career before, and because I'm a PDR doc, right. And, you know, and that from Coxsackie virus, but old, and I haven't seen anything in decades from myocarditis. So the lens has changed, and how we practice medicine now has to be viewed, because even kids who have not been jabbed may have been acquiring the spike protein from those who have been jabbed. Mm-hmm. And I do believe there's transmission. There's papers on it, Paul, that you can acquire it from especially the recently vaccinated. You can pick up the spike protein because it's a nanoparticle. It just, you breathe it. And it actually happened to me. So I know it personally and I know it professionally.
So our dear FDA, Food and Drug Administration, is about to, I suspect, approve this jab for 6-month-olds and up. What do you make of it? What should parents do?
I have now been unfortunately advising parents to create their own paradigm, their own structural parallel structure, as recommended by Desma, to get out of the system. Say no. I wrote an article with Stephanie Seneff called Pedicide. It's up on GMO Science. I think this is nothing short of massive pedicide. And I say not to succumb, not to give sovereignty away of your family, your body, your child's body to a government, which clearly is not protecting your child. And you must protect your own. If the pediatricians are not going to do it, then you need to do it yourself. And I know we are going to rise up. I have full faith that we as pediatricians will rise up, and parents must say no. And if it means pulling your kid out of theater camp or soccer school or whatever the heck, you know, is, then do it and create your own.
Yep.
And that's what I'm recommending, because I have been unable to protect here in where I live. We have not made any headway in altering the position of children vaccination. We've made no headway despite a call for it. We've made no headway.
Yeah, we testify to legislation, we testify at the FDA. I say we collectively, those of us who are aware of what's going on, we present science, and it's completely ignored as if this is just a fait accompli, railroad right on through. Parents, please listen. It is only you. Now, most pediatricians aren't going to protect you. The government's not going to protect you. Pharma has a bullseye on your kids, and they're stopping at nothing. They have no soul. They have no conscience. I don't know if it's pure money or if it's worse than that.
It sounds so dark and it sounds so negative, but actually it's enlightening, because what we're saying is to parents, you can do this. Our grandparents, great grandparents, knew how to do this. We're empowering you to take back your kids' health. And we're teaching you, like one of the new websites we just launched, Regeneration Health International, RHI.bio.
Yes.
First of all, food is medicine. You can begin to heal yourself, your family, or if you're well, there are people who are still well out there, to look in your pantry, to use food as medicine. We teach you how to do that. You grow your own herbs if you can. If you have a plot, you grow your own food. You reinstate your children's joy. You get them off their devices with all that subclinical messaging. You get them out in the dirt. You play in the park. You take them to the beach. They run barefoot on, you know, in sand. That we can redo this. And if you have to homeschool your kids, well, then do it. Then if that's what it would take, and gosh, I didn't want to homeschool mine, but if that's what it takes, then we would have to do that now. And I'm not, you know, do I want to be giving this message? Absolutely not. Do I want to be saying people avoid the pediatrician's office? Absolutely not. Pediatricians are my dear friends. They are good people. They care about kids. But this divergence is massive. I'm sorry about it. All I could say is I support you families, and we have to make tough decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. RHI.bio, right?
Yep.
Fantastic website. Food is medicine, regenerative agriculture. Thank you for being a part of establishing that. Also, folks, you can go to drmichelleperro.com. I know now you've said it, you're going to have to come through with those educational videos for us. In closing, I would love you to review the Children's Environmental Health Bill of Rights. I just stumbled on that today before our interview, and I just thought, wow, we all have to get behind this, folks.
So what that is something I wrote up last year. And because I was shocked, horrified, every other horrifying adjective you can think of regarding the assault on our children. And so I thought, can we get behind a global initiative to protect our children from environmental harm? And I proposed six simple things. There's one, children require organic food, free from chemical inputs. Two, so that would be number one. Two, children require clean air, because pollution is the leading killer of children, is pollution, especially small children under the age of five. Children require clean water. An EW study showed that tap water is contaminated. Children require to be free from medical experimentation. So we should not be using our children as little lab rats. Children require to be free from 5G. 5G is harmful. Electromagnetic frequencies are harmful. RFR, radio frequencies, are harmful. And last but not least is, please do not allow our children to be e-waste scavengers. So when we're dumping our electronic mass abroad in China and parts of Africa, children are scavenging for heavy metals, and they're toxic, as well as women. And last, if I could adapt that now, I would put a seventh on there, Paul, is children need to be free of Hollywood. Because I believe that messaging that the children receive and advertising is can be particularly harmful. And I'm worried about normalizing certain not child-friendly ideas and policies that are coming to our purview. I don't want to go into it because it's kind of dark, that I say may be free from this marketing. And yeah, maybe that begins with Hollywood. So can we protect our children even from images and movies and things that they should not be seeing? Because that affects brain function and their neurochemistry and who they are. So that's the Bill of Rights. And I hope we can all get around that to protect our children globally. This is not an anti-this or an anti-that. It's a pro-child movement. Truth is powerful. And courage is powerful. And we stand with truth and we stand with courage. And not only are they powerful, but they will increase your vibrational frequency higher. And you, if you can discard the fear, discard the negative imagery, discard the messaging we've gotten for the past 2 years, let it go and resonate higher. It will resonate your own health higher and your children, because you share your energy with your kids. So let's all practice that together, where we can reset ourselves to be positive influences in the world. And this movement, and it's a movement, Paul, that we're creating, there is, I say, let the negative stuff go. We are solutions-based, food-forward, regenerative community. And we network together to build our community better. I was borrowing something from Biden. I kind of quickly edited it, but I don't want to say build back better, but we build in our network. So we are in community. We are not alone, and we're not based on fear.
There you go, folks. Wow. Thank you, Michelle.
Paul, my pleasure. I am honored to meet a pediatrician like you. So thank you.
So I just wanted to add, those of you who are watching our show Against the Wind, you see my segments from the heart, you see the show we're bringing to you. I wanted to add the fact that if you have not yet become a member, I hope you will. What I'm offering for members is access to information that's not available to just the general website population, those who are watching the show. Almost everything we do is free for the show. So you don't have to become a member, but if you want to support the work I'm doing and get some inside scoop on everything Dr. Paul, that's the way to do it. Become a member. It's less than $5 a month, and it does a lot to support our show, because there is a production cost that is significant. And for the most part, we've been doing most of this work without any kind of financial gain. So appreciate your support and become a member. Thank you. I'm Dr. Paul.
Welcome, Bernadette Pager. You are host of Informed Life Radio, an incredible show, but you're also here as the Be the News segment of Against the Wind, and you have been such an instrumental force in getting important information out to the world. What I tasked you with today was, what do you think of this sequence of events that led to total approval by all the agencies to give these COVID jabs for six-month-old babies and above?
In short, I am appalled. at the sequence of events because supported the authorization. And I agree with many top medical doctors around the world who are saying, FDA and CDC, you just killed the entire vaccine program because nobody can trust you. I'm going to play for you the CDC's spokesperson.
Thank you for joining today's Director Debrief. COVID-19 vaccines are now available for children under five. With this recent authorization from FDA and recommendation from CDC, nearly 20 million children are now able to get vaccinated against COVID-19. I know many parents with very young children have been anticipating this day. We now know, based on rigorous scientific review, that the vaccines available here in the United States can be used safely and effectively in children under five. Vaccinating young children is a critical opportunity to protect them against hospitalization and death from COVID-19. Parents, I strongly urge your children vaccinated. If you have questions, talk to your child's provider to learn more about the benefits of this vaccine. We have taken an important step together in our fight against COVID-19 by making safe and effective vaccines available for our little ones. I will take advantage of these life-saving vaccines and protect their children.
Wow.
Comments?
So when you have a smiling talking head acting like, so isn't this so wonderful? And then what comes out of her mouth is all lies. These jabs are not safe. They're not effective. They're not preventing COVID. They're not preventing hospitalizations. They're not preventing deaths. In fact, I imagine you're going to get to a little bit of data, but it's a disaster. And they just roll this out with that old safe and effective mantra.
Yeah. They do. It's so disturbing, and it like completely undermines all faith in anything that the CDC has to say. In a nutshell, the facts are that for children, and I would dare say for adults, the shots are all risk and zero benefit. There are no long-term clinical trials now, nor will they. They have unblinded all the studies after a certain length of time. With the children, it was only, I believe, 6 weeks where they actually switched groups. The placebo group then got the shot. So 6 weeks worth of data, that's it. They have negative efficacy, ADE, antibody dependent enhancement, which is something that you might want to talk about here in a bit. I'll just kind of go through the list. Imprinting, also known as original antigenic sin. We can discuss that quickly too. The predicted biologicality, the adverse events being reported, right? We heard all of these scientists and doctors come forward before the shots were released to say, look it, here is a scientific evidence of the dangers of what will be seen. And even the FDA and CDC had on their list of adverse events of special interest to look for. They knew that these shots could cause these problems, and yet they proceed. And then we know that treatments exist.
Right.
So I'm providing for your viewers three key resources. There are many. This first one here is a letter to the UK, and at the end I can give you provide you the link of United Kingdom doctors and scientists, and it's mind-blowing. They say it is incomprehensible to consider that this represents sufficient evidence on which to base a decision to vaccinate healthy children. This letter goes on and on, dissect the studies being used, and then they go on and show so much more evidence of harm. It's a fantastic source that I encourage people to explore. We'll give you that link. And then there's the Heart Group. They've been all over. They too, they wrote a second open letter to all members of the FDA committees. And they have pointed out, like, let's just read that first quote, that the safety and efficacy of the Spikevax, that's the Pfizer one, in children and adolescents, Moderna, less than 6 years of age, have not yet been established. No data are available. No data are available. So what is it that Rochelle Walensky is telling the American public, telling parents when she says that they have rigorous clinical trials, rigorous studies? What is she talking about? They do not exist. So the HEART group, and then the Global COVID-19 Summit. These are fantastic doctors from all over the globe, including Dr. Pierre Corey, Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Robert Malone, a lot of people that you've had on your show. They have this fantastic dear physician colleague letter that parents can bring to their pediatrician. And it, we need to recruit more and more doctors to stand up against what's happening. And so here's the resource we'll provide on your website with the links where people can go. And the fourth one on there, besides those web pages, is Jeremy Hammond's wonderful in-depth article on original antigenic sin. It is, he's a brilliant investigative. And if you want in-depth coverage on a lot of topics, a lot of specific issues having to do with COVID, go to Hammond. He is brilliant and such a gift. So I'll stop right there.
That's fantastic. I think viewers, we just want you to have those resources. Dig in deep before you allow your child to be injected with a totally dangerous, worthless jab that's all risk and no benefit. I know that's not what you're hearing from your doctors, your pediatricians, and other providers who are themselves under a spell of safe and effective when it comes to vaccines. They're prevented from talking about risks of COVID jabs. Literally, you will be under board investigation if you even talk about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I know because I am. And yeah. I'm not even talking about it to my patients. I have a gag order. That's how bad it is. I am not allowed to talk about vaccines, especially not allowed to talk about the COVID jab, period. So you have to go to these great resources and so many more. Thank you, Bernadette. Dr. Paul, thanks for watching the show. Please visit doctorsandscience.com. There you can access our members-only section. This show is member-supported. We don't have to take sponsors. We don't have to have anybody controlling the content of our show. This is a huge perk most people aren't aware of. Your membership gives you access to my ebooks, transcripts of every show, PowerPoints from talks I'm giving around the country, and live bonus peeks at behind-the-scenes work we're doing, my off-the-cuff thoughts and reviews on current events. Your support makes all this possible. Thank you. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com, sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.